Okay, in our final installment, I would like to start off by talking about Israel as a democracy. We have something to be proud of and something to be embarrassed of simultaneously. Because democracy, even people in high position can be held accountable for their crimes. And simultaneously, we had a chief rabbi, a former president, and a former prime minister all serving time in jail. The chief rabbi and the prime minister for monetary crimes, and the president for sexual misconduct. Now, the prime minister that I'm talking about is Ehud Olmert. We already spoke about last class, talking about him as deputy prime minister and feeling the malaise of always being the winner and having no, you know, backbone to continue fighting the fight. We spoke about him taking over for Kadima and leading them into the second Lebanon war, which he was found guilty of not properly planning the war that led to so many failures. And yet, there is something that we should discuss that was possibly the shiny moment of Ehud Olmert's career, not just as a prime minister, but as in his life, and that is a not-so-well-known episode where the Israeli government decided to blow up Syria's nuclear reactor. We had spoken about Menachem Begin in 1981 blowing up Iraq's nuclear reactor. It had never been done before by any government. No one had ever taken out a nuclear reactor. And it was actually done a second time. Deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra would put it. In the year 2006, September 6th, 2007, the Israeli government once again sent in a special squadron of planes that flew in and took out Syria's nuclear reactor. Rav Bina's son-in-law, Yaakov Katz, editor of the Jerusalem Post, wrote a book called Shadow Strike that details all of the debates that were going on, both in the Israeli government and the Americans. Israel had told the Americans all about what they discovered. Begin had made a speech after he blew up the reactor in 1981, saying that Israel would not be gassed again, not on my watch, not going to have a destruction, not going to have another Holocaust. And this sort of became the Begin principle, that even though there are enemies with conventional weapons that might be lining up on our border, Israel cannot tolerate an existential threat. And a nuclear bomb dropped in the middle of the country would be just that. It would be an existential threat to Israel. Now, what's the background? In 2004, there was a train traveling in North Korea that all of a sudden had a huge explosion. It was so big, it registered like a small earthquake. It destroyed a town. 2,000 people were wounded. Many, many were killed. And North Korea forbade reporting of the incident. No one was allowed to come in. Now, the Mossad notices what's going on. What they notice, which is even stranger for them, is that a Syrian plane lands in North Korea and bodies are removed. The bodies were of 12 Syrian scientists. They were being transported in lead boxes by men in hazmat suits, which obviously aroused their suspicion. Who knew that there was even a connection between Syria and North Korea? North Korea, the rogue state that was constantly testing nuclear weapons. All of a sudden now, Syria, neighbors with Israel, having a connection with them, aroused the Mossad's suspicion, and they started to look into it. In 2006, they hit the jackpot. Mossad was following a Syrian nuclear official in London, and they were able to break into his hotel, and they hit the jackpot. They found in his hotel room, while he was down at the bar being entertained by another Mossad agent, they found his laptop out, and they downloaded all his files, sent it off to Tel Aviv. What they noticed were their pictures and diagrams that in northeast Syria, in the desert, far from Damascus, there was a nuclear reactor, exact replica of one that was found in North Korea. They found pictures of North Korean and Syrian scientists standing side by side. Okay, it was clear to them that what was being developed here, Syria was building a nuclear reactor. Okay, now they brought news to the United States, and there's all sorts of reasons why the Bush administration decided that they were not going to take care of it. They already had gone into Iraq on faulty information, thinking there were weapons of mass destruction. They were waging a war in Afghanistan. Should they can now also open up another front? For them, it wasn't conclusive enough, even though the Vice President Dick Cheney felt they had to teach the North Koreans and the rest of the world a lesson that if they violate their agreement, they would be held to pay. He was overruled by basically everyone in Bush's inner cabinet, and it was now left up to Israel. Olmert decided that Israel could not allow Syria to have on its doorstep a nuclear reactor. First thing they had to find out, though, was how far advanced it was. If the nuclear reactor was already hot, since it was so close to the Euphrates River, if they were to blow it up, it would then pollute the Euphrates River, which would then, for decades, affect the lives of Syria and Iraq with poisoned water, and therefore they had to make sure that it was not yet hot. They sent in a unit of Sayeret Matkal, landed by helicopter a mile away. They came in the night, they took samples, they were able to find out, get back to Israel, that it was not yet hot. They took samples of the dirt and the water in the area, and they were able to unequivocally see that there is a nuclear reactor that is being built here, but it was not yet hot. September 6, 2007, Israel sends in a special squadron of planes armed with bunker bombs that could blow up this nuclear reactor. They made the same mistake that Saddam Hussein made, that it was just one place. Syria thought that it was far away, no one knew about it, and therefore they were able to come in. They went out to the Mediterranean, flew up, and came in along the border of Turkey, and then down into the northeast section of Syria. Four planes came in, bomb after bomb after bomb, and they were able to blow up the nuclear reactor. Now, the big question that everyone had was, what would be the reaction of President Bashar Assad? Would he now go to war over this? The army was on high alert, waiting for an attack. The intelligence units, intelligence felt that Assad would not go to war, assuming that Israel did not brag about what they had done, for fear that, first of all, the entire world would know that he was illegally building a nuclear reactor, and also how well would they do in a battle. Could also be the people will be upset. Here it is, they're starving and they're taking so much money building a nuclear reactor. Would it unite them or not? The gamble paid off. Assad declared on the nightly news that some Israeli planes had flown over the border of Syria. They were repelled by Syrian aircraft. Some of the Israelis' ammunition fell in a deserted desert, causing explosions, but no harm, no harm, no foul. Israel got away with that. Now, this was not the end, because if you have the know-how, 5 years later, you could probably reproduce another nuclear reactor. So Israel decided 1 year later they had to take out the architect of the nuclear reactor, General Mahmoud Suleiman. He was too heavily protected in Syria, but based on intelligence, they knew that he sometimes went to this coastal home where he had parties. There, the security was less. In front of the home, it was on high alert. But what the Israelis did, they sent Shayet at Shlosh Esrei, the Navy SEALs. They came in a fishing boat about a mile away. They went with scuba gear and swam the last mile to get there. While he was in the middle of his cocktail party surrounded by guests, the Shayet at Shlosh Esrei came on shore and they shot him, one in the head, one in the neck, killing him instantaneously, and they were able to escape before anyone knew what was going on. So here was another example of the Begin principle, not allowing an existential threat. Ehud Olmert's finest moment he couldn't even speak about. There was silence because, as we said, we didn't want to draw Syria into a war. And it only came out later when the United States started talking about it and bringing other countries up to speed. And as I said, now you already have a book by Yaakov Katz. You can also go on YouTube and look up Operation Orchard, and you get about a 50-minute, two-part, like 30-minute and 25-minute documentary reenactment of what Israel did, Operation Orchard on YouTube. Now, I want to switch gears and talk about the problem in Israel with the Palestinians. The truth is, the Palestinians got stuck here when the war ended. And you can make the argument that Ben-Gurion made a colossal mistake. He should have transferred all the Arabs out of Israel in 1948 at the end of the War of Independence, the way most Arab countries did to the Jews. Kick them out of the country, and then we wouldn't have the quote-unquote Arab, Palestinian problem in Israel today. What most people fail to realize is that they don't just have a dream of nationalism. They want to have statehood like the Jews. This is what people used to think. Rather, what they're looking for is the destruction of Israel. We saw this when we discussed year 2000, Ehud Barak, far-reaching concessions, and the talks blow up and it leads to the Second Intifada. We saw this when we spoke about the Gaza disengagement, which then was followed by Qassam attacks, the Second Lebanon War, with cheering Palestinians after Israel withdrew its troops. Israeli Arabs identify with Hezbollah, including Knesset members. They call for resistance. When Israel retaliated against the missiles in Gaza or against the missiles in Lebanon, the Israeli Knesset members called them Nazis. This was a wake-up call that they will never be patriots, citizens of Israel. They support Hezbollah. They view Yom HaAtzmaut. They call it Nakba, the tragic day. They argue to change the structure and the definition of the state from Israel, state of Israel, from a Jewish state to a democratic state of all its citizens. They want to do away with all Jewish symbols. We shouldn't have Hatikva as a national song. We shouldn't have a Jewish flag that looks like tzitzit with the tchelet and a Magen David. They want to do away with the law of return. They call for liberating Jerusalem like the Muslims liberated from the Crusades. They have patience. They have communicated. They have patience to wait it out. For them, it's a war of attrition until we leave. And that's why it's somewhat shocking for many in this country that now, as we speak, we have Benny Gantz that's willing to make a minority government using the 15 Arab Knesset members, many of them supporters of terrorists, open supporters of terrorism against Israel, just so that he should have a, be able to become prime minister. Now, what should Israel do? Israel's got to be tough. It has to be the anti-Ehud Olmert line that we said before, we're tired of winning. We have to win. We have to be strong. When Israel is about to enter Eretz Yisrael, so we know that Reuven and Gad approached Moshe and said, we'd like to stay on the side. And Moshe gave them Musar and said, you're not going to go and fight with the rest of your Jews. If Jewish survival is at stake, every single Jew has to be willing to fight for the collective good. And if that's what's going on now in the Jewish state, everyone has to be willing to risk his life for the sake of the Jewish people. Right? This is what it means to be a Jew. We see Megillat Esther. It's an interesting halacha. You're not allowed to miss even one word of Megillat Esther. We don't find this in the regular Torah reading. We don't find this when we're going to be reading the Haggadah from Pesach. And the same thing applies where? By Parshat Zachar. You have to hear every word. What's the reason? Could be, once again, we need to read the whole story. We have to know that when Jewish lives are at risk, Jews have to be called upon to stand up and fight. What did Mordechai tell Esther? He said, don't think that you're safe. Okay? Rather, Revach v'tzala yavol yudim makom acher. Jews will be saved, but you need to take a stand. You need to fight. This is what the Jews are being told. This is what Moshe told Reuven and Gad. This is what Mordechai told Esther. Jews need to stand up and to fight for what they believe in. Now, we had mentioned that Menachem Begin, when he went to speak with Jimmy Carter, refused to have as a concession that America recognizes Israel's right to exist. Abba Ibn said this in the United Nations. He said, nobody does Israel any service by proclaiming its right to exist. Israel's right to exist like that of the United States, Saudi Arabia, and 152 other states is axiomatic and unreserved. There is certainly no other state, big or small, young or old, that will consider mere recognition of its right to exist a favor or negotiable concession. Okay? And this is perfectly logical. However, Benjamin Netanyahu made this a prerequisite in his talks with Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, or the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, that there has to be recognition. He felt that just as Israel is prepared to recognize a Palestinian state, Palestinians must be prepared to recognize a Jewish state. Why did he go against Menachem Begin and Abba Ibn? Because he felt that the Palestinians need to make a psychological change, that they have to accept the right of the Jewish people to a state of their own. This has to be beyond dispute. And what's interesting is that Abbas has never done this. Palestinians have never done this. Their rejection of recognizing Israel as a Jewish state is the underlining problem that we have. Any concessions that people talk about, any sort of land for peace, is missing the point. They do not recognize Israel's right to exist. Now, everyone's heard of the BDS movement. Okay, if you're going to be on college campuses, so you'll probably come firsthand to hear about the BDS movement. Now, what's the sole purpose? You have to understand, the sole purpose of the BDS is to destroy Israel. BDS has no interest in protecting Arab life. If it did, it'd be boycotting Syria for murdering over 500,000 Arabs. If it had no interest, it has no interest either in the Palestinian rights. If it did, it would be boycotting Egypt for destroying hundreds of Palestinian homes on the border with Gaza, trying to stop smuggling of weapons by Hamas. BDS has no interest in protesting occupation. If it did, be boycotting China for occupying Tibet since 1950 and Turkey for occupying Cyprus in 1974. BDS has no interest in promoting Arab human rights. If it did, it would be divesting from Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, Qatar, Syria, Lebanon, and every other Arab country where Arabs are denied the most basic rights like freedom of press, freedom to protest their government, freedom to vote, all of which are guaranteed to Arabs only in Israel. BDS trades in anti-Semitism with its primary objective being the economic destruction of the world's only Jewish state and the Middle East's only democracy. In Israel today, there are 1.6 million Arab citizens who make up 20% of Israel's population. These Arabs enjoy the same rights as their fellow Jewish citizens. They, along with Christians, Jews, Baha'i, Hindus, women, homosexuals, all have equal rights to live their lives in freedom and safety. There are many notable Israeli Arabs, including two Supreme Court justices, the captain of Israeli soccer team, Hapoel, the Israeli ambassador to Ecuador, and a general in the IDF. Arabs have their own political parties and have served in Knesset as members of their own parties, as well as the non-Arab parties. Israeli Arabs, like minorities in every country, have complaints, but they still appreciate the freedom they enjoy, despite the nationalist feelings and the support many have for the creation of a Palestinian state. When they're asked whether they would prefer to live in Israel or the Palestinian Authority, 77% chose Israel. Moreover, 64% of Israeli Arabs said that Israel was a good country to live in. Now, Palestinians who live in the West Bank are not Israeli citizens, and therefore they are treated differently. Israel's security requirements trying to prevent terrorism have sometimes forced Israel to impose restrictions on Arab residents of the West Bank and Gaza. This has been necessary ever since 1967. Israel's policy is not based on race. It's just based on Palestinian animosity and terror attacks. Palestinians in the territories dispute Israel's right to exist, whereas the blacks in apartheid South Africa didn't seek the destruction of South Africa, only the discriminatory regime. Now, depending on the situation, Israel either tightens or relaxes restrictions in the territories, relative calm in the West Bank, for example, has allowed Israel to dismantle many checkpoints and allow approximately 50,000 Palestinians to enter Israel to work and enjoy the same workplace rights and conditions as Israelis. Even more surprising, 25,000 work inside the Jewish settlements. Okay, Neve Daniel, most of the people that are building are Arabs that live in the area, in the West Bank. Since the signing of Oslo in the 1990s, 97% of Palestinians in Yehuda v'Shomron have been governed by the Palestinian Authority. And following Israel's disengagement from Gaza, 100% of Palestinians there have been ruled by the Palestinian Authority and now Hamas. The denial of basic freedoms these Palestinians face, such as, we said before, freedom of assembly, speech, and press, are attributable to Palestinian, not Israeli policies. Palestinians in the territories aren't blind. They see how Israeli Arabs are treated, and they're envious. That's why when asked what government they admire most, more than 80% of Palestinians consistently said Israel. By contrast, Palestinians place Arab regimes, including their own Palestinian Authority, at the bottom. Now, why does any of this matter? Why does it matter that we have academics that consistently bash Israel and turn a blind eye to any other country? Why does it matter that former President Jimmy Carter wrote a book called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, right? Not even referring to the country as Israel, but Palestine, evoking images of apartheid, which he obviously knows it's not. Why does it matter if Ahmadinejad calls for the destruction of Israel? So I'll tell you why it matters. Okay, the Nazis did not begin their mass murder of Jews without laying the groundwork first. Anytime you go into Yad Vashem or in the Holocaust Museum in Washington, what you're first met with is the cultural changes, the dehumanization of Jews. All these pictures and posters of them as rodents with the big nose and the Russian sign in one eye for communism and the dollar sign for capitalism, and making it much easier to exterminate rodents, right? This is what the Nazi writers and artists and politicians, they all worked on. They were able to develop a culture that genocide would then become possible. Had they just started right away with mass killings, who knows if it would have been successful? Who knows if there wouldn't have been a backlash? It's only possible with people like Ahmadinejad and Carter gradually, subtly preparing the world for a world without Israel. Delegitimization is what's required before you can go on to the next stage, which is wiping Israel off the face of the earth. Already in 1919, Hitler declared that his goal was removal of Jews together. 6 years later, when he wrote Mein Kampf, he spoke about how some 12 or 15,000 of the Hebrew corruptors of the people, if they would have been poisoned before or during World War I, Germany wouldn't have lost. And that when he comes to power, so then he's obviously going to settle scores with the Jews. This is already disgusted. Jews were depicted as vermin. Okay, Germany was infested. All of Germany's ills were blamed on the Jews. They were demonized in art, in literature. Laws were anti-Jews in Germany and in Europe, and they were trying to dispense of the Jews. And when the final solution came around, there was not much of a backlash. Today, we have the same idea in the Muslim world, and people just shrug, right? People watch protests in Iran where they have Shihab 3 missiles draped in the emblem, Wipe Israel Off the Map, that's written graffiti on these missiles to take out Israel. Now, with all of this, we should understand that it's our job to be spokesmen for the state of Israel. But instead of ending on a down, I just want us to appreciate the miracles that we've seen. We went from the miracle of Purim, and we're about to start the miracle of Pesach. And if we look around and we see the modern-day miracles of the creation of the state of Israel, we'll have tremendous hakaras hatov. We have to realize that a powerless people scattered around the globe, victims of the greatest catastrophe in human history, we are granted international legitimacy to create a state of our own in our ancient homeland. It is remarkable how a poorly trained, poorly equipped Jewish army defeats the combined might of the Arab world. Later, a better trained, better equipped army defeats not once but three times Arab forces with greater arsenals and manpower. And now, a nation the size of New Jersey boasts one of the most powerful armies in the world. A nation of immigrants from more than 100 countries, including from authoritarian governments, becomes a democracy, right? This is not something to be taken for granted. Over 100 countries, speaking over 100 different languages, should have been, you know, Migdal Bavel. We came here and we built a democracy in Eretz Israel. And in now a little over 70 years, Israel has grown from 600,000 Jews, like the number that came out of Mitzrayim that entered Eretz Israel, to close to 7 million Jews living in Eretz Israel. And in these seven decades, we have advanced, technologically advanced, on pace with the greatest high-tech companies in the world. Universities in Israel have become world-class. Hospitals, world-class. The ancient community of Ethiopia is transported on the wings of eagles to the Promised Land. The long-suffering Jews of the Soviet Union witnessed the collapse of communism, and more than 1 million emigrate to Israel. The King of Jordan and the President of Israel stand at Har Herzl for the funeral of an Israeli Prime Minister. The crippling Arab boycott crumbles. Israel signs peace treaties with Egypt and Jordan. Israel has one of the highest economic growth rates in the world and has a very special relationship with the most powerful nation in the world. It became an independent nation in the shadow of the greatest catastrophe in Jewish history. Jews from around the world, with minimal support from the international community, used their creativity, determination, and courage to establish a model society. An Or LaGoyim. Israelis have fought and died to keep their nation free, knowing their first defeat will be their last. Even between these wars, Israelis have known no peace as terrorists plot against them day and night. Still, they stand tall, proud, and unafraid in their homeland. It's our job to appreciate the miracles that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has wrought for us, and we pray that we move from this beginning stage of Echalta de Geula to Geula Shlema.